we will be doing sitting and walking meditation. And we'll start with a sit here in just a minute. And then there will be four small groups, two today, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and the same for tomorrow. And the groups, the first group this morning will be for people, if there's enough people to justify it, people who are relatively new to meditation. So how many people would view yourself as relatively new? Well, that's not quite enough, then I'm going to do it a different way. Okay. Because I have to accommodate. The next room next door will accommodate like 20, 25 people at a time, right? Okay. So we'll do what we will do is we'll do by somebody can figure this out by alphabet, you know, where to how far to go this morning. So using last name, and so we will have these. We'll have our sitting and walking. I will do a series of small talks through the days. So there will be a couple talks in the morning and a couple and maybe two in the afternoon, but we'll see. And there will be time for question and answer in this larger group. And then there will be, of course, when we have our small group, you can ask more personal questions and all, because that's what that time is for. And what else would I say about this? We are going to be looking at the subtle aspects, some subtle aspects. The Four Noble Truths are considered by all the different yamas, all the different lineages of Buddhism, to be the core teaching. So there's universal agreement on that. Interpretations and all kind of go from there, but everybody agrees that the Four Noble Truths contain all the teachings of the Buddha, and everything else is like an explanation of those Four Noble Truths, or instructions in how to realize them. And so we're going to be looking at those in various ways. And then I will be bringing out things that like I did this book, Dancing with Life, about the Four Noble Truths. And it's this basis was that there, it's from one of the most ancient of the existing texts of Buddhism called Samyutta Nikaya. And in that version of the Four Noble Truths, they're presented as 12 insights. And that each of the Four Noble Truths has three insights that we're to realize. So it's the Four Noble Truths as practice. And in that sense, a better description of the Four Noble Truths, which I did not have the nerve to do when I was writing Dancing with Life, would be to say the Four Ennobling Truths, because the emphasis is actually on the learning, the becoming, the bhavana it's called, rather than on this kind of static identity. So Four Ennobling Truths, and I really like that. And I say it in the book, but I didn't dare name it that way. Although now other people are starting to say it, so maybe I would have had more courage now. But so we're going to be looking at it that way, and then we're going to be looking at some of the implications of that. That as opposed to just I'll go through the teaching as practice, but then we're going to look at some of the implications that would not ordinarily necessarily be mentioned, and it has to do. The reason I want to do this is that it has to do with how we actually have our daily life be the major part of our practice, because that's where we spend most of our time in our daily life. We're not mostly on the cushion. We're not mostly on retreat. And so if we don't use that time to practice, there's actually not that much time left to practice. And life becomes much more interesting as practice than it is as achieving and getting and being safe. It's much more interesting as practice. At least that's been my experience and people I've worked with. So we will start now with a 40-minute sit. And make yourself comfortable. Those of you who are relatively new, you can shift your pelvis area, the buttocks, and like back and forth this way, and then forward and back till you find kind of the sweet spot. We want the spine to be relatively straight, but relatively straight for you might be like this. That's like right now. That's what's straight for you. So don't get some imposed idea, but find what's comfortable for you. And it's okay to move around. Just be quiet, please, when you're moving around. Also, if you're getting sleepy, it's perfectly fine to do standing meditation for a while and sit back down. If you're doing standing meditation and you really still feel sleepy, then I would ask that you stand with your eyes open. I've actually twice in my life fallen down doing standing meditation when I was practicing late at night, because you know I was kind of that kind of yogi, you know, who was maybe a little too intense and not being balanced in his practice, and so at some point the body just takes over and down I would go. But you go very slow. It's interesting enough. You don't topple like a tree. But in here, there's not much room for the falling around. And although we do have the windows open, we're going to have a balance of heat and all of this. And so we're all going to be adjusting during the day. It's going to be either a little too cool or a little too warm. And that's just going to be the nature of practice in this room. So practice in this room is like this. Okay, and this first sit is something I've been doing for the last couple of years, which is called arriving. So we start with an arriving practice. And as I said for the people who were present last night, this is not just for getting started on your cushion. It's also for your daily life when you're, you know, with difficult relatives at the holidays, or you are in a work situation where you're a little tense or you're a little uneasy and you don't really arrive in the room. If we are not present, we've already given away so much of our empowerment. And I use this word empowerment because power can be such a charged word. If I ever use the word power, it is not power over, but it is having agency, being able to affect ourselves, being able to affect others and the environment, just as the environment and others and our unconscious habitual behavior is affecting us. So agency is to get to dance with life, to be affecting and being affected. And empowerment means that we have the internal organization that allows us to be affected by another, to be an open to being affected by another without losing our agency. And very very much the Buddha Dhamma can really serve us in terms of those areas where we may have had various kinds of traumas or struggles that we find a way to organize that's more subtle, deeper than the way we are sometimes organized based on the conditioning we've received. I was directing someone how to get into the room. That's what I was doing. And I don't think he's coming in. He's going on. It was a different group he was looking for. All right, so here we go. Eyes closed, if you're comfortable with your eyes closed. If you're not comfortable or if it helps you if with sleepiness, you can have the eyes open down at a 45-degree angle. And we deliberately, mindfully arrive. Arrive where? Here. Arrive when? Now. Here in this room. Now in this moment. T- To be able to reside in the here and now is to be present. To be present allows mindfulness to be a continual flow. To have a conscious relationship with the flow of life, moment by moment. Not in a theoretical way, not in a philosophical way, but in actual experience. Here, now. Here in this space. Take note of the space. That you're here at the university, that you're here in this room, that you're here now in this room. And being in this room at this very moment feels like this. You may notice it as the temperature or the sense of the presence of others or the feel of the room to you. Bringing mindfulness front and center. You know you're utilizing mindfulness. You're inviting it. Reflecting for a moment on the aspirations that brought you here. So often we forget when we're starting to practice our aspirations. But here and now, acknowledging the wholesomeness of the aspiration that brought you here. In Buddhism, this is right view or wise view. First of the Eightfold Path. And then reflecting on who you wish to be moment to moment in the here and the now. This is based on our values. You, based on your values. The intention of being moment to moment. Goals in life change. Goals as a parent is different than goals at succeeding at work versus being a good citizen and on and on. And we employ different means, different skillful means towards those goals. But the underlying values, this intentional living, doesn't change with the goals or what skillful means are being employed. They're core values from which we view all experience. We've arrived in the room. We've arrived in mindfulness. We've remembered appropriately. And now we turn to the experience of the body. The body here and now. You may feel the body as a whole, just this feeling of body. And as you stay with it, various sensations come up. Or as soon as I mention this word body, you may be aware of individual sensations much more than any sense of the wholeness of body. Both manners of perceiving are just fine. They both lead us to the same destination. It can take a while to really arrive in the body. We're not in a hurry. You might notice the feeling of the feet on the floor. If you're in a chair, the bottoms of the feet. If you're sitting on a cushion, the sides or a bench, the tops. So you feel the feet. This is body sensation. Or you feel the buttocks and the whole pelvis on the chair, bench, cushion. Or you feel the sensation in the hands, whatever it is they're touching. You may notice sensations based on the fire element, where it's warm or cool. You may notice it in terms of the earth element, hard, firm, heavy. Or not hard. This earth element. Or you may notice it in terms of the feeling of connectedness. The feet connected to the ankles, connected to the lower legs. Flowing up or flowing down. That there's these sensations, but there's a field we call body. That is somewhat bounded. Only somewhat, but definitely has boundaries. One part of the body that gets so emphasized, part of the body experience, is that of the wind element, what we call breath. So now, turn your attention towards, called aiming it in Theravadin Buddhism, Vataka in the Pali, and sustain your attention on the breath. Vichara. The breath is part of the body experience, I say again. So we can have breath and body intermingling. And then later on it may become just breath, but there's no rush. This breath here, now, this inhale here, now, this exhale here now. As we are so deliberate with the breath, it may change its pattern. We're not controlling the pattern of breathing. We're receiving it, allowing the breath to breathe us. So if something spontaneous starts with the breath, ride along with it. Sometimes being with the breath can bring us to some other physical sensations, some of which are quite positive, but others which can be a little disorienting. You could feel your fatigue. You could feel an emotion that you didn't realize you had had. Just by the breath, it's kind of amazing. So you may be fully with breath now, or you may be feeling the breath in the foreground and body sensation in the background, or body sensation in the foreground and breath in the background. That's all balanced. Or you may have this experience that I term breath in the body, where the body and breath are so merged as a single experience. Note that at times the mind wanders away from breath and body to thinking, planning, fantasizing, commenting on our experience. When you become aware that's happened, pause for a moment and just recognize the experience of being pulled away. Each time is a little different that we're pulled away. And then, having just had this moment of pause, redirect attention to the breath. Sound comes and goes. No reason for any disturbance of mind. If you feel collected and unified in the mind, you might start to notice when the mind wanders away, when it's pulled off by a stimulation of thought or a smell or taste, or whatever form of internal, external stimulant. Is it pleasant or unpleasant that pulls us? Always returning to the breath, gently but firmly, establishing this contact so that the knowing arises that the breath feels like this. last night I read four lines from T.S. Eliot from something called The Rock that he did in 1934. And he says, "Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" I tell people that when they're looking for teachers, there's three kinds of teachers. There are information teachers that have information, and lots of times that's what you need. You're interested in an area that's new to you. If they've got information, that's good enough. But one wants to realize eventually that this is what they're providing, because not to confuse that with knowledge. Teachers with more experience or more insight are at the knowledge level, so they offer knowledge. For me, knowledge is the level where you really know how to apply the information to have knowledge, to have wisdom. And then the third level is a master. And a master knows how to live out that knowledge based on that information. And in areas of our life, we can aspire to the level of information or to the level of knowledge or the level of mastery. We're not going to be a master in many areas of our lives, so one wants to be realistic about this. So going back to Eliot's lines, from the bottom up, where is the knowledge we have lost in information? We are flooded in our time with information. And so much information that it's hard to find the knowledge amidst all the noise of the information. And then where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? In relation to knowledge, there's so much information that leads to so much knowledge and so many specialties of knowledge now that one can get think that that's the whole purpose of life, is to just get to knowledge and really lose the fact that that wise living, that wisdom is something that's beyond just the knowledge. It's a kind of mastery of that knowledge for applying it in life, to apply it in life to what end? To be able to recognize suffering and non-suffering from a Buddhist point of view, and to be able to realize that we have a choice oftentimes. Not always, but we often can only know by the attempt. We have the choice to choose non-suffering over suffering. It's reordering of our psyche once we really know that's true. It reorders the psyche, that because we're identified in the struggle of the getting and the surviving. Sometimes I call it surviving and thriving. That we don't realize. No, there's a sense of well-being. That's the real thrust is towards a well-being, not just to get more, not just to get more knowledge or more information or more material goodies, more toys, more status, more power, but to have a sense of well-being that's other, comes through information and knowledge, but it's something other. It's a different ordering inside, and the Buddha so beautifully points to this. And so part of our looking at the Four Noble Truths, we're going to be looking at it in this way. And those of you that were here last night, actually I should have asked that, how many people were at last night's thing? Okay, and then hands down, how many were not? Quite a bit. So then I'll go through the whole explanation of the gap and all again. So we will see that it's not that easy to know how to work with ourselves so that we actually can take the Buddhist teachings and live them out in our lives to really be to reorder our perception in such a way that we're seeing things from this clear direction of well-being, and we're able to choose well-being, because oftentimes we have a gap between what is a suffering and the recognition of it. There's a gap there. It's just a gap. We don't recognize it. It's a chasm that we can stay in, where we're like, later on we pay the price, but we're not recognizing it as we're starting, or even in the middle sometimes, only at the end, but sometimes in the middle. So there's this gap there. That's the first of these three gaps that I talked about last night, where the Buddha is, first noble truth is that there is dukkha. It's one thing that there is dukkha. There's another thing to perceive, oh, this is dukkha. And so that we learn to discern what is suffering, what is not suffering, what is satisfactory and what is unsatisfactory. There's the temporal satisfaction of a quick, brief moment, like you're really angry and you yell at somebody because you're angry. And then that's a very short-lived satisfaction, usually. Not if for the first time we've ever claimed our power, that's a whole nother matter. But there's the longer-term satisfaction. So we learn to really discern what is suffering and what is not suffering. And the Buddha is very clear that we confuse this, and we'll look at that later this morning. And then the second gap that occurs is when, although we've recognized that, making this call to my difficult sister, this is just going to be upsetting, and here we're going down this line, that we've recognized that, but we fail to realize, oh, but then I have a choice. I don't have to do it. I don't have to say yes when my frenemy calls me and wants to go to lunch, where she or he is going to be putting me down, that if whatever I say that good happened in my life, they'll up me, they'll top me in the area that I'm reporting, rather than being happy for me. They'll say, oh, I've done that before. Oh, you should have gone to so-and-so while you were there, and so forth. You know those. Maybe you are one of those. Form of dukkha in itself. And so that's the second gap, that we don't realize that we recognize, this is not satisfying at all, and yet we don't realize we've got a choice. We just go ahead and live it out anyway, based on habit, based on expectation of others, based on what we think we're supposed to be doing, based on simply no one ever saying you've got a choice. One of the thing I do when I'm not teaching Dhamma is I offer these change and transition workshops for people. And one of the things that I do in that workshop is point out the various choices people have. And it's often people are shocked that they have certain choices, that they don't have to do what they've always been doing, that they don't have to measure everything by success and all this. It's great fun when that happens. So this recognizing that, yes, this is unsatisfactory, this is dukkha, this is not wise choice, and then, oh, I have a choice here. I do have a choice. I can choose otherwise. It doesn't mean that each time we think we can choose otherwise that we will. And that also causes people to give up way too early. Because it takes a long time to build true choice in areas where you're really charged or really habituated, or it's so wired in so early in your life. So it can take years, literally, before in certain areas of your life that you can say, oh, this is suffering, this is unsatisfactory, this is stressful, all of these different word meanings of dukkha. But I have choice, and it really be true in that area. But you only know by trying. And if you don't recognize there's a choice or the possibility of choice, we never choose. So we don't start to dance with life. We've given up before we've ever started. And it's okay if we try to dance with life, you know, and we stub our toes or we get spurned. We don't, life dances with us in some way other than we were trying to choose. It's quite okay because it's just practice. If you start to view your life as practice, then the stakes change. Because the reward is not this moment, but this arc of empowerment. This arc of empowerment. And it flows that way. I can really promise you that, but you have to see for yourself. Ei pasako, the Buddha said, come see for yourself. But it really does change that way. How far we can go in this lifetime, it varies for each of us and all, and we don't really know that. But that you can really have a new orientation, a new perspective from which you are measuring things, seeing things. That's pretty much assured if we embrace practice. And again, this isn't a belief. I'm not talking about a belief here. I'm talking about a practice that you go. You're a scientist. You're seeing what's true and not true. You're seeing what can be replicated. You know, and it's that kind of an orientation. It requires a kind of faith, that yes, this might be true, that one can have this kind of relationship with life. And amazingly enough, it might even be true that I could do it. Despite all of my, whatever your all despites are, that you could do it. And that requires a degree of faith. And the enemy of faith is doubt. And so we have to acknowledge doubt and establish this realization that there is choice. And we do that by having little small choices we make where we say, oh, in this moment, I didn't have to get upset over this person in the office that bugs me. I could just see them as suffering rather than, you know, taking it personal what they're doing to me. It's just this person suffering. The kind of thought where like, well, I have to put up with this for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes once or twice or three times a day, he or she has to live with themselves 24/7. Ugh, I'm the lucky one in this situation. So that we start to, we little small achievement of the realization of choice, and then it goes from there. And then this third level, and where there is yet this gap, is that we are mindful. This is not skillful. This is dukkha. And we remember, oh, yeah, I have choice. There's choice. There's some choice here. And then we don't take the choice. We don't take the choice. We open the refrigerator door at midnight, and we eat our food at midnight, and therefore don't sleep well, and therefore are tired the next day at work, and whatever it is that is your thing, that you say yes too many times, you overschedule, whatever it is. And for me and our larger Sangha, our larger community, why is it, as we've actually grown so much in people having an understanding of mindfulness and how to really cultivate mindfulness in themselves, why has that not had more impact in people's lives? And it has had a lot of impact, but why not more? It's because of the not bringing the practice into daily life about being mindful in relation to what is suffering and not suffering, and because it's not then remembering that one has choice. And then and this third one, which is even though one is mindful that this is suffering, one realizes one has choice, and one somehow falls into this chasm, this gap, and doesn't make the choice. And so it's like we recognize we have choice. We recognize this is suffering. We realize we have choice. But then there's this resolute action that's coming out of Chanda, this aspiration. Coming out of resolve in the what's called the paramis, these attainments of capacity, like patience and resolve together are so powerful. and we cultivate patience and resolve in relation to actually being able to make the choice. We actively choose. We don't just kind of go along as a sort of victimizing ourselves, as it were, where we are our own limitation due to habit, due to perception, due to not having a clear relation to stimulants. So a stimulation being like, I want to see that television show. So it's now midnight, and other people are talking about it, so we go to Netflix or to Prime or something, and we watch that show. And now it's 2 a.m., and we got to be up at 6:30 to get to work or whatever it is. We're able to really have a larger view of ourselves in this way, and so that's part of how we learn to dance with life, how we learn to have a new relationship to the Four Noble Truths, is this kind of approach, and we're going to be looking at some of that today, and in terms of the first two of the Four Noble Truths, and. If this is not practical, if it can't be applied in daily life, I'm not interested in it. I'm not interested in theory that can't be lived out. I'm not interested in philosophy that cannot be lived out. Life is too short, and whatever role I am playing in the community, while I have time left to play it, my emphasis is on the empowerment so that it really shows up in your life. We've really done a decent enough job of helping people collect and unify the mind, which is we call concentration samadhi, and to move into this mindfulness realm. But now let's as a community, let's really see what we can do. All of us together, and it helps so much to be with a practice group, right? Like sitting, it helps to be sitting with a group. So, but this idea that we're together holding the aspiration. I have a teacher in India. My prime teacher is the Venerable Ajahn Sumedho, and he lives in Thailand now. And I was just with him. But I was also just with my teacher in India who taught me this series of teachings called the Teachings of the Nine Bodies. And he has this distinction that I've never heard anyone else make between achievement and attainment. And as soon as I heard it, I was going, that's true. This achievement is something within our ego, that we're disciplined and we've got some natural thing that helps us, like we can concentrate or we can really hold ourselves accountable or whatever it is but the ego can go, good job, and that's a wonderful, that's part of practice, is that we apply ourselves and we really feel like, yes, I am, that there's a sense of our own agency in that way. But there's certain things that only come because they come, and those are attainments. We can't do that. So, like for instance, in the most simple way, we can't say I'm going to go practice insights, even though this is an insight practice. You can't practice an insight. An insight comes when the conditions are right. And insight is like an aha moment, so it's not deductive or inductive. We can reflect on it, we can inquire around it, but when an insight comes, it just comes. And the insight is what's freeing. It's like, ah! It's a bolt of lightning. It's the seeing through, this vipassana kind of, oh, I get this. And so that's what I mean by an attainment. So there's a degree of... like with equanimity, like with forgiveness, there's certain things that occur as capacities in us that we only attain. You can argue, was it always there and we've cleared out all these things that have been distorting us? Or you can say that it was developed. I'm not so interested in that argument. because it doesn't lead to the application of the practice. So, but there are two different views about that, and one teacher's going to tell you one thing, one's going to tell you another. So, but either way, you think it's true, that you already are these things, and it just needs to get, you need to get these things that are hindering you, these that are fetters, get those cleared out, and then your innate Buddha nature shows up, or you attain Buddha nature by your practice. And either way, this kind of thing happens. So that's what we're exploring. And now we're going to do our walking practice, and we will walk till 10:05. So come, we'll start coming back at 10 o'clock. I'm till 11 o'clock, sorry, to 11:05, and start coming back at 11 o'clock. And people, what would be the first group?
A through D.
A through D next door.
And just in case, this is the first letter of your last name, in case there's anybody who's only coming today and your name is later than K, because the morning is A through D, the afternoon is E through K, come to one of the morning ones. But I think that the registrar has figured it out. So this morning is A through D, as in David, and then this afternoon will be E through K.
Okay. And this is your, there's like five of you held up your hand as first time, you can come to this one regardless of your, of where you fit in the list if you're new. So the walking practice, you can walk at three speeds, which is kind of a school zone speed of strolling. There's a half school zone speed, which is a bit more deliberate, and then there is this really slow zombie-like walk. One is not better than the other, but one does get to notice more of the felt sense of walking when one's walking slower. So you can use noting to help you with this. So when you're doing the walking practice, if you're strolling, you might notice left, right, or step, step. Or you notice the foot lift, and then the other foot lifts. Or you notice this foot places, now this foot's placing. If you're going slower still, you might notice lifting and placing, lift and place. As a felt sense, not the coconut, but the felt sense. This is just used to register it. It's lighter than any piece of paper, that registering, the noting. It's all in the felt sense. And then if you're walking slower still, you might notice lifting, moving, placing. And that's a three-part walk. There's a six-part walking, Burmese walking style, that's six-part. It goes on and on like everything, and the Buddhist minds take everything down into small bits. So, and the idea is that you're staying present. It's a concentration practice because you're staying with one set of experiences over and over again. It's also balancing the sitting to get the blood flow and all of this, and it's also a practice that of discipline, and it also is a time when insight arises. Some people have had most of their insights occur even after long practice during walking practice. And one of the ironies is that it's not unusual that someone will come in at the first of like a month-long retreat and tell me, I hate this walking practice. I do it, but I sort of miss a lot. Now, I really insist they walk a lot. A couple of you in the room may have had run into that with me. And then oftentimes that is a very personal come in and say, I just had this great insight while walking, even though they really thought they disliked it. Or sometimes it'll be like, oh, I didn't get this. Now I get it. I love walking practice. So you're just having your experience now, but you're practicing practice, so you don't mind what the experience is. You like it or you don't like it. You're practicing practice.